Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. This is episode 391, recorded on August 1st, 2021. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And on the line from New York City is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Bill. Hi, Rachel.
So this week's episode is on the industrialization of glassware. So I'll start off by talking a little bit about pre-industrial glassware. Before we get to Kelly and Rachel on some of the specifics of the period we're going to be focusing on. So the history of glassware production in the United States goes back to the earliest mainland English colony at Jamestown, Virginia, although that production was mostly a failure, much like the colony. By the early 1600s, when Jamestown was established, the English had become a significant producer market for knockoff Venetian-style glassware, a wildly expensive, closely guarded, and highly skilled craft production for centuries in Venice itself. The colony at Jamestown built a manufactory for glassware. It was a primitive facility, difficult to heat to the required molten temperatures, and staffed by German-Polish glassblowers. The Jamestown glasshouse would have been a proto-factory of the type just beginning to emerge in Europe in the transition from urban craft economies to a proto-capitalist combination of urban consolidation or rural distribution of piecework. Manufactories represented the interim step between putting out piecework to a literal cottage industry and mass production of identical goods. As we discussed in our episodes earlier this year on early 19th century American shoe and boot production and on early 19th century arms manufacturing, there was quite a long process of change in production of things before the development of interchangeable parts with which to genuinely mass produce identical goods and dramatically reduce costs for consumers. And this was especially true in a more complicated industry like glassblowing, which couldn't evolve toward a mass scale not only until the technology was ready, but also until the advent of coal-fired furnaces. Broadly speaking, however, the production of glassware in the Americas followed a similar arc of change to many of our other topics. First, the de-skilling of a craft production where possible, and the consolidation of at least partially interchangeable labor under one roof. Next, the mass production of interchangeable parts and products during the First Industrial Revolution. And finally, the mechanization and automation of that production process during the Second Industrial Revolution. As we'll see, this industry was one that resisted the de-skilling and mechanization processes longer than most, again, because it was such a complicated process. But in the end, the same trends arrived there as everywhere else under industrial capitalism. The change in the mode of production made glassware a cheap, replaceable, ubiquitous good instead of an exclusively a costly luxury. In particular, this week we'll be talking about the American consumer goods revolution that was the mason jar, among other things. But we'll also be talking about the shocking labor implications of mass production of cheap glassware and its automation. I'm also going to note here that we won't really be talking much this time about flat glass, such as windows, or about optical glass or light bulbs and vacuum tubes, because we ended up with more than enough content just on glassware. And for some more information about the material that I just talked about, you can read the notes at arsenalfordemocracy.com in a PDF, as always, with this episode. And specifically, I was looking at a Great Britannica Encyclopedia article on glass properties, composition, and industrial production, as well as a Corning Museum of Glass article on Venetian-style glass produced in places like England or then, you know, the Jamestown colony. And Corning Museum of Glass was started by one of the major American glass manufacturers, Corning Inc., which we're not going to really talk about in this episode. It's kind of an interesting company history, but they do have this very extensive museum on the complete human history of glass. So Kelly, I will turn to you now. As I noted earlier in my introduction, we see that there's this phase of sort of trying to consolidate craft production into manufactories, but you're still really relying for quite a while on pretty skilled labor to produce each item. And you're going to talk now about the transition over time, especially in the 19th century, away from a purely craft-skilled profession to a relatively still highly skilled, but definitely more mass-produced and gradually more mechanized production of glassware.
Absolutely. So you'll notice the theme throughout this is that the limiting factor of glass production for the longest time was just the amount of heat that was required to melt this glass to keep it hot while you shaped it. There aren't very many materials in the world that are suitable for this sort of heat. And so one of the first improvements that came along was that originally, these craftsmen had been using these clay crucibles or pot in which the glass was melted. Clay cannot withstand particularly high temperatures, and so it was really a process prone to error, prone to to lots of breaking in time, in energy consumption. And so one of the first improvements was this blowing iron, which came around. And if you think of glass blowing, or you Google glass blowing, you will likely, first thing that will pop up is this wrought iron glass sort of rod, which people use to sort of wrap and melt the glass and then blow into it for that sort of bowl or bulb shape. And obviously the improvement here is that iron can withstand much higher levels of heat than clay. Additionally, in the 17th century, cone shaped, or what were called English glass furnaces, came into play. In these furnaces, the material to be melted was placed slightly underground above a tunnel that brought in high velocity air drafts, which allowed the furnace to increase the temperature greatly. And so there's clearly a need to get higher temperatures faster and with less energy. And this English glass furnace was one of the ways in which that was introduced. However, the big improvements came during the 18th and 19th century while people began to understand the law of thermodynamics. Primarily the first law of thermodynamics, which, in case you don't quite remember that, that's the law that states that energy can neither be created or destroyed. So it means that the heat that is required to create these high temperatures for glass, it has to come from somewhere. The heat isn't spontaneous. It's not random. Any process that requires heating has to account for where the heat is coming from. So when trying to heat or cool something, you can be really precise about determining the temperature by controlling the amount of energy that you put into it. And this really revolutionized the process of making glass. One example of this is the Seaman brothers and Chance brothers were working together in England. And in 1816, they were able to create a regenerator-equipped furnace that used about one-tenth the fuel of old furnaces. So basically, the system was able to capture the heat, keep the hot air moving from one chamber to the next instead of just letting it escape. So rather, if you're picturing sort of a fireplace, instead of just constantly feeding in wood logs that are going to burn off and sort of dissipate into the air, they're able to capture that heat and keep it in the system, making it possible to produce glass with a lot less energy. And in 1867, Frederick Siemens took this technology to the next level by creating a cross-fired furnace equipped with regenerators. And so this was essentially a much larger system, one that had three chambers, one for melting, one for refining, and one for working. And this meant that the craftsmen could work on more than one piece of glass at the time. You weren't sort of starting from scratch every time, which made it possible to make glass a little bit cheaper and with a lot less energy. A few of the practical uses of that we're going to discuss today include bottling, pasteurization, and mason jars. So again, we're not quite getting into the industrialization of glass yet. That this is a science that has improved over the next 100 years, but it really people create more uses and then have to figure out ways to make more bottles, which then creates more bottles for more uses. And so over the next 100 years, you really see quite a few uses for these bottles. The first example I'm going to talk about is the beverage bottling industry, which beverages had been bottled for years, hundreds of years, but that it was expensive. Particularly wine bottling was quite expensive, and early efforts at mass production began by the end of the 1730s. But like light bulb manufacturers of the 19th century, they weren't quite able to mechanize the craft process and could not avoid using skilled glass blowers to produce each bottle carefully, even if they could at least ramp up the number per worker per day. A few decades later, carbonation made this a potentially huge market, and apparently soda or pop drinks in glass bottles were popular by the 1850s. But you can imagine this was probably still more of a skilled, labor-intensive craft manufacturing industry than a true mass-produced factory system. So there was a growing need. By 1859, John Landis Mason established the screw-top mason jar, and that had a huge effect on the average American home, or many American homes anyway. The process of heat-based canning is one in which food is pressurized and heated to destroy bacteria, and this was popularized by Nicolas Appert, a French cook during the Napoleonic Wars, who, because of the uncertainty of the time, really saw value in preserving food for longer periods of time. His initial design for this sort of canning, and this is Tray French right here, he used champagne bottles sealed with cheese and lime. Of course, this was not the ideal design, and this poor seal made this process quite prone to error. He later switched to a wider mouth glasses and distributed food successfully to the French Navy, but it was still quite an imperfect process. And so Mason's design, which included the screw top and that little rubber band underneath that really created the seal, this made canning a much more widespread and successful way to store food. And home canning is essential in parts of America where there are shorter growing seasons. So imagine that you're living in Maine, you have a beautiful garden for like 6 or 8 weeks a month. Life is amazing. You have food and vegetables all the time. But what are you going to eat the rest of the year when the ground is frozen and you have no food? And so the answer to that, of course, is this canning process, which would allow you to store food for winter months. The mass production of mason jars in the 20th century, particularly by the Ball Corporation, which we'll talk about in just a moment, really made this canning technology available to all. And I linked an Atlantic article which talks about sort of the reputation of mason jars and mentions that part of that is sort of this like democratizing food DIY spirit that people still feel apparently when they see mason jars. Interestingly, Mason neglected to patent the lid of his jar, which was like really sort of the magic maker here, because it included that rubber ring, which made the seal possible. And like almost a decade after he created it, he tried to patent it. But at that time, the design was just so ubiquitous, it was impossible to sort of get back. So he allegedly died penniless in 1902. We still use his design today. Part of me wonders if one of the reasons it became so ubiquitous and widespread is because there was no patent. And so many different manufacturers and people were able to produce this without really regard for patent or giving Mason his fair share. Like I mentioned, the Ball Brothers Glass Manufacturing Company was a really key player here. This is another iconic second industrial revolution corporate titan that began producing paint cans and then began buying up all the other supply chain components like glass liners until they were an enormous one-stop shop. The patent on mason jars expired and the Ball Brothers seized on the opportunity and began really ramping up to produce tens of millions of mason jars per year by the end of the 1890s. The firm eventually produced all of the various components of the jars, like the metal lids and rubber seals, as opposed to just the glass itself. And by World War II, Ball produced an outright majority of all American canning jars. And after the war, they faced antitrust restrictions handed down by the Supreme Court, which of course just goes to show how large and ubiquitous they had become. Nevertheless, they continued to expand by producing glass for aerospace uses, such as satellites. And the Ball Corporation today is a global conglomerate, but they no longer produce mason jars because in 1993 they sold off the division that makes mason jars. Although you will notice that if you buy a mason jar, the Ball trademark is likely still on the jar, as they license that name for continued use on new jars. It's worth mentioning that there was a failed strike in 1910 against the Ball Corp in Muncie. Like we've alluded to in past episodes, that was a period when socialists were particularly strong in Indiana. And so perhaps a topic for another day, but worth noting the strike there in 1910. Another way in which this glassware really sort of revolutionized the American home and homes around the world, was that they became a key part of the pasteurization process. The process of pasteurization is not so different from the process in canning, in the sense that the basic premise is that you put the liquid in a glass jar, drop it in hot water to kill the bad bacteria and yeast, and then cool it. And keeping it sealed prevents any additional bacteria or yeast to enter the container. So this mason jar process in glass in general is so key because, one, the glass can withstand high heat. So when you drop it in the liquid, you're able to kill the bacteria without busting the jar, although glass does break at really high heat. So be careful trying this at home. And then keeping it sealed, that seal on the top prevents new bad stuff from entering it once it has gone through the pasteurization process. And so Louis Pasteur, a name that we sort of all know and love from, middle school science class, he's the namesake of pasteurization. And his breakthrough was that he established this germ theory of fermentation. So when things ferment, it is not just like a spontaneous process, but rather a process that is caused by a germ or microorganism within what is being fermented actually causes that fermentation. So by dropping your milk into like a glass jar and then into hot water, killing those bad germs, that prevents that fermentation or the bad bacteria from appearing later on, so long as it's sealed and no more bad stuff can get in.
So as Kelly has noted, there was a clear cycle here over the course of the 1700s and then the first half of the 19th century and into the second half of the 19th century, where as production became easier, faster, and cheaper on glass products, you would then see the market expand because you could now make more glass products. But as various markets expanded, you suddenly had more demand that required much greater volumes of production. And as noted earlier, that could really only be achieved with various technological breakthroughs, better scientific understanding of things like not just germ theory and stuff, but actual production of glass and how glass works, both during the glass making process and afterwards, when you're storing it and so forth, as you just discussed with the issue of potential temperature shattering and things like that. And as also we mentioned earlier in the episode, this remained such a complicated industry that by kind of the transition between the first industrial revolution to the second industrial revolution, you had gotten to a point where maybe one skilled guy could be working on several glass items at a time, as opposed to just one at a time. But this was still clearly not going to be necessary for the production levels that were required. And so there wasn't really a clear breakthrough point because there was this sort of transitional period in the mass production and consolidation into factories and things like that over the course of the 1700s and the first industrial revolution period, especially in the first half of the 19th century. But as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, we know that in most of these industries, the transition in the second industrial revolution comes to mechanizing and automating those processes that have been established, so you can produce at much larger volumes, and so you can form these giant second industrial revolution corporations, multi-state corporations, and then multinational corporations like Ball Brothers that we just talked about. So Rachel is going to talk now about the mechanization and automation of industrial glass blowing in that second industrial revolution period, and its implications, obviously, on both the consumer market and the labor market as well.
So as Bill just mentioned, the mechanization of glass blowing, regardless of its labor saving or profit boosting implications, was always going to be crucially necessary for the glass industry to be able to produce the sheer volume of glass necessary to feed the roaring American consumer economy that Kelly just mentioned, which started in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Not only for home and kitchen glassware, windows, and scientific equipment uses, but also simply billions of light bulbs and radio vacuum tubes. A single worker with a machine was eventually going to need to be able to produce hundreds of thousands of glass items per day instead of just hundreds per day. So there had to be a change in production from a person to a machine. So pulling from that Encyclopedia Britannica article that we've pulled from extensively so far, there were the principles of the press and blow process for making wide mouth jars. So with the press and blow process, there is a gob of glass, which is a solid cylinder of molten glass, which is sheared to the weight specifications that will become the final product. In this case, there's very little waste glass that is discarded. And it's pressed into a mold by a big metal plunger. And this creates the basic dimensions of the final of what will be the final container. And then there's a final blowout process, which blows it out to the desired dimensions of the container. And this process for making wide mouth jars were shown in the United States by Philip Arbogast in 1882. And the blow and blow process for making narrow neck containers or tapered neck containers was demonstrated by Howard Ashley in England in 1885. And so in this case, there's still a gob of glass getting put into a mold. But in this case, there's two blow processes. There's the intermediate blow, which creates the details of the glass, such as the screw threads or the sealing surface that the rubber cap is going to go onto. And then there's a final blow, which blows it out to the final desired dimensions of the container. So these processes employed manual delivery, fully automatic jar forming, and then there was also a variation on the blow and blow process called the suction and blow process, and this was perfected by Michael Owens over the period of 1895 to 1917 at the Toledo, Ohio Glass Company, which subsequently became the Owens Bottle Machine Company. The automatic single gob feeder was developed in 1919 to 1922 by Carl Piler of the Hartford Fairmont Company in Connecticut. And fully automatic machines followed, but the true rugged survivor, which utilized fully automatic gob delivery to the maximum versatility, was the individual section, or IS machine, invented by Henry Engel at the Hartford Empire Company in 1925. And what it really revolutionized was being able to section out those gobs in a really efficient manner, and also maintaining the molten glass in its molten state in a manner that made it immediately available for the shaping of the glass. Also, what really revolutionized it was like parts of it could be removed to be worked on, but the machine itself could still operate while parts of it were being worked on. So it was just very highly efficient at sectioning out the gobs of glass to make containers. So there were labor implications to this automation. And as we've kind of mentioned in the past, automation in the late 19th century is credited with displacing child labor. And a big example is the automatic glass bottle blowing machine, having been said to do more to end child labor than child labor laws. And at the end of the 19th century, the years of schooling for children began to increase sharply. So there were management-friendly craft unions that kept the peace between adult laborers and glass manufacturing companies, but by and large, they totally ignored and failed to protect the vast numbers of expendable and supposedly less skilled child laborers employed in the industry. Right now I'm quoting from a University of Toledo article about the history of glassblowing. The manufacture of bottles and jars during the 19th century used the method of mold blowing carried out by shops consisting usually of 5 to 7 people. Each shop employed 2 to 3 skilled blowers and finishers, and 3 to 4 young boys who opened molds and carried the product from blower to finisher to cooling oven. The blower used much the same methods in creating cut glass pieces, but inserted the glass into a hand-operated mold, and once closed, blew into the mold to create the final shape of the bottle. Although the glass industry remained fairly unaffected by mechanization during this time period, one significant development was the organization of the workers, occurring during the latter half of the 19th century. Between 1877 and 1878, Local Assembly 300, Knights of Labor, was organized by window or flat glass gatherers in Pittsburgh. By 1880, it merged with blowers, cutters, and flatteners and became known as LA 300 Window Glass Workers of America. The formation of this national union signaled the beginning of a rigid, detailed, and all-inclusive system of regulation of window glass production that lasted into the early years of the 20th century. LA 300 established production limits, restrictions, and regulations of apprenticeships, and controls over wages. At the same time, the manufacturers of window glass also organized, forming the American Window Glass Manufacturers Association. Working with LA 300, the two groups kept industrial strife to a minimum, despite fluctuations in the market. In similar fashion, the bottle and jar skilled laborers were under the jurisdiction of two unions depending on the type of glass used. The Green, or Common, Glass Bottle Blowers Association formed in 1890 as a merger of several unions, and the American Flint Glass Workers Union of North America organized in 1878, which joined the American Federation of Labor in 1889. The only unprotected workers in the glass industry were the young boys, sometimes referred to as blowers' dogs. Union restrictions on the number of apprenticeships, most often reserved for relatives of the skilled workers, resulted in few, if any, of these boys moving into more skilled positions. By the end of the 19th century, child labor laws enacted in several states prohibited the employment of children less than 14 years of age. The glass industry, however, was notorious for needing and using underage boys. Boys as young as 8 were taken from orphan asylums and poorhouses by both men and women who claimed they were guardians, providing affidavits as to the boys being 14 or older. These guardians lived on the wages of the children. Work was difficult and hard in the glass factories for these young boys. The earnings of the blowers depended upon the speed of the boys who fetched and carried for them. No restrictions existed on night work, and the sharp contrast between the heat of the ovens and the cold of winter nights resulted in many boys dying from pneumonia or other diseases. Skilled workers and children were used in the glass industry, and although they worked together in shops, the separation between the skilled blowers and finishers, the batch mixers and furnace tenders, the apprentices, and the boys was rigid. Each shop, depending on the size, included a gaffer or foreman, and one or more gatherers, blowers, servitors, or helpers, carry-in and carry-out boys, and mold tenders. The factory also included batch mixers, furnace tenders, layer tenders, box makers, and packers. Factories even employ young girls to weave covers for hand-blown bottles. So there was obviously a point when the mechanization of glass blowing and the speed at which glass manufacturing occurred that was really detrimental to workers, especially these young boys and girls. But then further innovations in the technology were able to remove these young, unprotected, unorganized workers and enabled them to be children and to go to school. So there was definitely some growing pains involved in this mechanization process, but I think as we mentioned, removing them from the process did more for child labor than the actual laws prohibiting child labor. So where is glass manufacturing today? It's considered a mature market business. World demand for flat glass was approximately 52 million tons in 2009, and the United States, Europe, and China account for 75% of demand, with China's consumption having increased from 20% in the early 1990s to 50%. So a typical glass furnace holds hundreds of tons of molten glass, and so it's really not practical to shut it down every night, or in fact in any period short of a month. So therefore, factories run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And what this means is there is little opportunity to either increase or decrease production rates by more than a few percent. There's a high initial cost. New furnaces and forming machines cost tens of millions of dollars and require at least 18 months of planning. So given this fact and the fact that there are usually more products than machine lines, products are sold from stock. So the marketing slash production challenge is therefore to predict demand both in the short 4 to 12 week term and over the 24 to 48 month long term. And factories are generally sized to service the requirements of a city. Glass is very expensive to transport, it's very heavy. So in developed countries, there's usually a factory per 1 to 2 million people. And a typical factory will produce 1 to 3 million containers a day. So there's really not much wiggle room. I know there's been a lot of emphasis put on production lines, supply chains, especially over the length of the pandemic. And so glass is a relatively static and stable material. So it's kind of interesting to see how it seems like it's almost resistant to the quote-unquote just-in-time supply chain and manufacturing philosophies. So despite its positioning as a mature market product, glass does enjoy a high level of consumer acceptance, and it is perceived as a quote-unquote premium quality packaging format. And I think today, especially as we're looking at the environmental impacts of various materials, I think glass is seen as a more quote-unquote sustainable material than plastic. And I've kind of seen kind of a return to glass as kind of a preferred container material rather than plastics. So it's kind of interesting to see how, if that trend continues or how it evolves over time. Kind of an offshoot, not super relevant to the manufacturing and mechanization process, is leaded glass. So leaded glass was very prized in the 18th and 19th centuries for its clarity and refractive properties. It's the cut glass, the cut crystal containers like decanters or goblets that are seen as very high class. And they're still prized today for its clarity and refractive properties. But because it does have quite a high level of lead in the glass, it's not recommended for daily use, extended storage of liquids, or use by children. And an interesting factoid is it has been proposed that the historic association of gout with the upper classes in Europe and America was in part caused by their extensive use of lead crystal decanters to store fortified wines and whiskey. And there has been statistical evidence linking gout to lead poisoning. So it's just kind of interesting that we had an entire upper class of people in both Europe and North America that were just basically poisoning themselves daily by storing their fortified wines and whiskey and other alcoholic beverages in these lead glass containers that contained at least 24% lead oxide in the production of the glass.
Yeah, and that was not something that was like a major focus for the mass consumer glass that arrived with mass production, you know, whether you're talking about your green soda bottles or your mason jars and things like that. They weren't going for this leaded glass crystal goblet look. So they were less affected by this problem in the industry. Again, just to sort of recap what I said at the beginning, before we have a summary discussion here, you know, the production of glassware in the United States, it was a little bit different from some of these other industries because of the level of skill and complexity required to make this. Especially, we talked about the issues around temperature and how you have to kind of have continuous production and it's hard to ramp it up and down and so forth. But broadly speaking, we see those three phases again, where you're gradually trying to de-skill as much of the craft production as possible and consolidate that under one roof into what would become a factory. Then you're trying to make that factory be able to produce interchangeable products rather than custom products, and where relevant, have interchangeable parts like the metal lids and things like that. And then you finally see in the second industrial revolution that mechanization and automation of that production process, which simultaneously allows you to do things like eliminate child labor from the process, but also produce vastly higher quantities of items per individual worker. So productivity goes way up. But it's also worth emphasizing that's not something you can keep replicating. Glass, as Rachel said, glassmaking is considered to be a mature industry. There isn't a lot of wiggle room, as she put it. And so you aren't going to see those kind of explosive levels of growth happening in the economy anymore as you would have in, say, the late 19th century or even periods of the 20th century, because you really can't do much more to change these production processes at this point. So, Kelly, I'll go back to you at this point to see if you had any reflections on some of the aspects that Rachel discussed, sort of with the second industrial revolution period and that move toward actual mechanization and automation of those production lines that we started to see emerging over that long period from the early 1700s into the late 1850s and into the 1860s that you discussed.
Well, I do think it's interesting, the arc you just discussed, which has been relevant in so many of our episodes and in industrialization of different processes at large. And also the note she mentioned, I keep thinking about how this potentially did more to combat child labor than child labor laws themselves. And just thinking about what an incredible, this like very sort of industrial technological advance, what it impact it had on sort of the day-to-day experience in the childhood of kids around the world.
Right. And that had come across our radar earlier when we were doing that interchangeable parts episode, because as we emphasized there, the interchangeable parts and products stuff is not just about the thing that you are making. That's obviously important as well. And we've clearly talked about examples of that today. It's also clearly important to the actual production process and the machinery that is making the thing that you're making. And I think, Rachel, you talked about that in one of your examples, talking about a specific machine where you could be making changes and repairs and maintenance to the machine without shutting it down. And that is, you normally in another industry, you'd say, oh, they're being cheap, they don't want to shut down the production line. But if you, as you've just described, the temperature demands for the glassmaking process make it so that it is almost impossible to shut down production lines if you don't want to have to wait a month to ramp it back up. That's the kind of, you know, timeline that they believe that it probably took at that sort of primitive Jamestown glass house in the Jamestown colony. You'd have to really be like shoveling in logs, you know, or later on in other facilities, coal for an extended period of potentially weeks to get it to the temperatures you needed. And then at that point, you'd have to keep it there. So having those interchangeability components is really critical to keeping production lines operating the whole time in glass factories, so that they wouldn't have to shut down the entire production and lose huge amounts of molten glass they had been working on. But in doing so, we get this totally unintended side effect where we're able to finally eliminate huge quantities of child labor, which is obviously a really hugely positive development. Rachel, did you want to talk about any of the things that Kelly had discussed, particularly around the consumer economy implications and home life implications for glass and industrial glassware production?
Yeah, I consider myself kind of part of that DIY preservation of food stuffs tradition. In Idaho, we don't have we have a much longer growing season than, say, Maine, but we do have a pretty long winter season as well. So it does become important to preserve your foodstuffs. And I have been experimenting with pickling and other types of food preservation. So it's kind of interesting to see what a rich tradition and how far back it goes, preservation of food in America using these Ball trademark mason jars. And they're still the most trusted brand name today. Like, I think we specifically chose Ball jars just because they do have that that reliability associated with the brand.
Kelly, do you see comparisons here to any of the other topics that we've done recently that we haven't mentioned so far? For example, one that comes to mind is maybe sewing machines in terms of the impact that mason jars had. You get both the implication on your own family's life in terms of things you can do within your own home, but then also your potential ability to then make money off of something you would be doing just for your own family previously.
Yeah, I think sewing machines is a great example because it mirrors so many of the aspects that we've talked about here. One, your ability to make money essentially by this industrialization process, and like canning for others or canning in a much larger sense. Two, you are able to like take care of yourself and your own family. It has that immediate impact there. And then three, on like the larger scale in factories, it really had a huge effect on the number of workers required and really sort of lightened up the labor load in a way that made it possible for children to escape child labor experiences.
All right. Well, Kelly, thank you so much for coming on this week to talk about the Mason Jar, the Ball Corporation, bottling of sodas, things like that, that we might not otherwise be thinking about in the glassware industrialization process in the U.S. consumer economy.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Bill. New York says goodbye.
And Rachel, thank you for coming on to explain to us about the mechanization and automation of glassware production and how that affected child labor in the United States.
Thanks for having me. It was a really fascinating topic to research.